President Trump has been in office for just over a month, but there's so much political news, it's hard to keep track of it all. So let's take this hour of all things political to wade further into the headlines, and we'll find out what political developments you're paying attention to as well. Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on this Monday. We're joined by political scientist Jennifer Piscopo. She's an assistant professor of politics at Occidental College in Los Angeles. Her research focuses on gender and representation. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks, Kate.
Let's start with the annual gathering of the big name conservatives over the weekend at CPAC. President Trump headlined the event and spoke directly to his base. Let's hear a bit.
So I've been with CPAC for a long time. All of these years we've been together, and now you finally have a president. Finally. Took you a long time. And it's patriots like you that made it happen. Believe me.
So Trump first addressed CPAC 6 years ago. Do you see any evolution in his core message and the Trump the politician over these years?
You know, I think if we look at Trump's main talking points from CPAC, they are very similar to his main talking points, you know, throughout his campaign. And I think it's really during his presidential campaign over more recent time period that Trump developed some of these key talking points, especially about the economy and especially about the military. And you can hear even in that opening snippet the extent to which even Trump as president is still in, you know, Trump as campaign mode, sort of rallying people around himself as a savior. And I think that's really a version of Trump that we've gotten to know in the past 12 or 18 months more than the past 6 years. So his overall speech at CPAC and the tone to me was really consistent with how he's manifested during the campaign.
And how was he and his administration, who also had prominent speaking roles at CPAC, how were they received by conservatives? Did they rally around the Trump leadership?
You know, if we look at the recent approval ratings for President Trump that were released by Pew, when we break those approval ratings down by demographics that we typically associate with the Republican Party or with Trump's base, high levels of approval ratings. So white evangelicals, 78% in favor of Trump's performance as president thus far. And, you know, that's not true when we look at the similar demographic groups on the Democratic side. But when we look at this divided by groups, we do see that Trump is being very well embraced by some of the core supporters of the Republican Party.
And how do you see him being received by the GOP leaders in Congress? What is that relationship like?
You know, I think that the GOP leaders continue to be in a bind. And I think some GOP leaders, if you look, for instance, at Paul Ryan, are seeing an opportunity now with unified government, at least in the House, and having a Republican president to pass some of the agenda items that they have long wanted to see pass. So I think if you're Paul Ryan, your dominant strategy has been to try to work with Trump because his position in the White House might let you pass some of these policies that are really important. I think for other GOP leaders, perhaps they come from districts themselves that are more moderate or states that are more moderate, are in a bind between we see rising levels of some dissatisfaction from constituents in these angry town halls. But again, working with the president is your best chance of passing your legislative agenda. And so I think there's real anxiousness in some parts of the GOP, not all parts, about how they can continue to straddle this divide between working with a president to pass some policy items that are on their agenda, but working with a president that is extremely divisive and does have quite a lot of controversies surrounding him at the moment.
We're talking with political scientist Jennifer Piscopo on this edition of All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's take a call now at 1-800-642-1234. Kevin from Crandon. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Yeah, I just heard the top of the hour that Trump is plans on raising the defense budget 10 or 11%, which I think it's now at like $600 billion a year. I don't know. I'm just kind of guesstimating that, and that that's going to be accomplished by cutting domestic programs, which, gee, I wonder what that'll be. Will that be people's food stamps, their housing, health care? That's what I also heard. Yeah, health care is the cutting of health care is going to go quite a bit toward their spending on defense.
Yeah, and Jennifer, how do you see what we've been just hearing the last hours of this budget plan that's going to give a big boost to military spending, but also cut dollars to domestic agencies, as Kevin mentioned, like EPA and the State Department?
Sure. So that's true. Trump's budget proposes to add $54 billion back into defense spending. And while it is true that the defense budget has shrunk a bit since the height of the Iraq War, that defense spending continues to be a large priority for the United States, and the United States outspends similarly positioned countries on defense. The Trump budget would add even more to that. Now, what I read this morning is the draft plan would achieve this not by cutting Social Security or Medicare, but it would achieve this by cutting other programs like our caller and Kate, like you mentioned. And so I think there's going to be real question, and I think there's going to be real debate about this shift in priorities, so to take money away from environmental protection, away from the State Department, and towards defense. The State Department, for instance, funds a lot of U.S. aid programs overseas that work on economic development and peace building, and some might suggest that these programs also contribute to national security by encouraging the kinds of development that are positive and that are helpful for societies and might distract away from radicalization or engaging in military buildup in those countries. So I think we're going to see a lot of discussion about what kind of priorities this means for us as a nation going forward. And of course, domestically, not just internationally, there will certainly be programs that lose out, and there will certainly be Americans that depend on certain forms of government assistance to feed their families, to perhaps go to school, pursue higher education, that are also going potentially to lose out in order to fund the increase in the defense budget.
And what about sequestration? Because defense and non-defense spending is supposed to grow and shrink at the same time, but this budget doesn't align with that spending principle?
Well, right now we've just seen a draft budget, and I think it's really important to know that this might change and that we don't know what the final proposal will ultimately look like. And I do think that Trump and his policymaking team, they certainly have a vision, but they're not right now thinking about these larger technocratic issues, right? They're sort of putting their big policy goals on the table. It's especially very symbolic with CPAC happening this past weekend. And so I think for the finer mechanics of it, we're going to have to wait and see how those details roll out.
Jennifer, because you study gender and politics, I'm really curious what you think. White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway discussed her thoughts on women's equality and feminism at CPAC. She said she doesn't consider herself a feminist in the classic sense. Let's listen to what she had to say.
So I don't know about calling yourself a feminist. I also, for me, it's difficult for me to call myself a feminist in the classic sense because it seems to be very anti-male, and it certainly is very pro-abortion in this context. And I'm neither anti-male or pro-abortion.
What do you make of her views here on feminism and equality?
So what Conway does there is reiterate some classic conservative talking points about their vision of what feminism is. This is really not new for those in the conservative think space. So to accuse feminism of being anti-male and being pro-abortion, in continuing in that clip, you know, she goes on to say that she doesn't see herself as a victim. She sees herself as a product of her choices. And again, these are very classic conservative talking points. And what these talking points really do is misstate some of the goals of feminism as we would understand it. And so feminism is really about recognizing that society and policy have evolved, right, to grant more opportunities and rights and freedoms to men. So feminism is not anti-male, but feminism is about challenging some of the long-time structures and policies that were put in place to give men an advantage. But to frame it as anti-male is a very common conservative talking point to try to devalue, right, the broader claim that there are some ways in which society is unequal. And that's not the fault of any individual man, but it's the fault of very long-term historic and political processes. And that's the same kind of construction that you see around saying that feminism is about victimization, right? People who call themselves as feminists also do not see themselves as victims, right? They see themselves as involved in a larger structure of inequality. But I don't find Conway's comments, although I certainly don't believe she has the right end of feminism, I don't find them particularly upsetting because, again, they're kind of common conservative ways of trying to distract away from the real issues of inequality that feminism is getting at.
She also pushed back on the Women's March on Washington the day after President Trump was inaugurated, alleging that the protest organizers intentionally excluded conservative women who were pro-life. Does she have a point in that critique?
I think that there was a decision at the level of the march to not work with formally work with pro-life organizations, which certainly did not mean that individuals who support pro-life views were excluded from the march. And so I think this has been a longstanding debate in the feminist movement itself about being pro-life versus pro-choice. I think folks who support a version of feminism that's more pro-choice would not consider themselves to be anti-life, but they would, returning to the comment I made about long-term historical and social processes, highlight that favoring women's ability to make decisions about their bodies free from government interference is a core plank of the feminist movement, which is not actually the same as saying you either personally agree with or disagree with abortion in your private life. And so, again, I think individual decision-making versus the policy choice get conflated in these kinds of discussions about whether feminism is pro or anti-abortion or pro or anti-life.
And she also was very flattering of President Trump's treatment of women in White House positions and Trump the businessman. Let's just take a moment and listen to that.
He's been promoting and elevating women in the Trump Corporation, in the Trump campaign, in the Trump cabinet, certainly in the Trump White House. It's just a very natural affinity for him.
So President Trump has nominated four women to cabinet-level jobs. How does this compare historically for presidents and relating back to what Ms. Conway is saying?
Trump certainly is on the lower end of supporting women to high-profile posts in the administration, and I think high-profile is really key. If we look at the cabinet positions to which Trump has chosen women, for instance, former Governor Nikki Haley as UN ambassador, Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. These are actually not the highest profile cabinet posts that are available, both in general, if we were to compare across administrations, and also specifically if we look at the policy priorities in the Trump administration. We just finished talking about Trump's budget. His policy priorities are clearly focused on defense, on justice, Department of Justice, and on Border Patrol. And he, in fact, is looking for a more disengagement of the United States in global politics and particularly the UN. So not only does he have fewer women in higher profile posts, he's appointing women to the posts that are most marginal to his particular policy priorities. And I think that is something that we as political scientists, when we look at not just how many women, but we want to know where the women are, that is definitely notable.
We're talking with political scientist Jennifer Piscopo on today's edition of All Things Political. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. And we want to hear your take on developments coming out of the White House. What does your report card look like for President Trump's first month in office? What do you see as his victory so far? And where has he come up short to you? How do you feel about the speeches you heard at CPAC? What about politics and the Oscars last night? Join in this political discussion at 800-600-6400. 1-800-642-1234. Again, that's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. This is the All Things Political edition of the Kathleen Dunn Show. Good afternoon. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen. We're picking up our conversation with Jennifer Piscopo. She's an assistant professor of politics at Occidental College. Her research area includes representation, gender quotas, and legislative institutions in Latin America. We're discussing the politics coming out of CPAC, the politics out of the Oscars, what to make of Russia and internal leaks. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Now, Jennifer, last week the Trump administration issued new guidance outlining which restrooms transgender students can use, effectively rolling back previous guidelines put in place by the Obama administration. Can you explain this bathroom debate in the context of what it means politically for the Trump administration?
Sure, and I think that's the exact way to think about it. This is really... It's a symbolic policy. It has real-world consequences, but it for transgendered students. But it is symbolic in the sense that it really speaks to a key issue of Trump's base, particularly the socially conservative and/or evangelical base, right? And it sends a strong signal as well to the Democrats, because it has this broader link into where we as a society are standing right now with respect to equity and inclusion for LGBT peoples. In practical terms, what this policy means is that individual institutions, individual states will be able to set their own policy, but it does mean that if transgendered students experience this form of discrimination, they don't receive federal civil rights protections from the Department of Justice. As far as this goes for the Trump administration, you know, my gut instinct is Trump didn't spend a lot of time thinking about gay rights or transgendered rights prior to his election campaign. But this is certainly something that's important to his vice president, and it's important to his evangelical base. And this is a really a strong policy that he can hand them, and a strong signal he can send them that he's on their side, so to speak.
Yeah. And without these federal protections, states are allowed to enforce their own laws governing bathrooms or even religious freedom laws. Are you expecting to see a wave of states with Republican governors to pass more restrictive policies?
I am expecting to see that, and I would expect to see that irrespective of this executive order. It's really clear that insofar as we can speak of something called a culture wars, right, thinking about transgendered individuals and access to bathrooms has become a flashpoint in these debates. And we are seeing across the country states, largely GOP-controlled states, looking to press the issue on religious freedom in various ways. And so then it's actually not just about bathrooms, but it's about the ability of businesses to refuse service to people who have sexual and marital statuses that they disagree with. And so I think that this is part of a broader trend, and the ultimate goal is to have one of these cases come all the way through to the Supreme Court and to get a Supreme Court decision about this.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Jason in Greendale. Hi, Jason.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, I would say so far, what troubles me most about this administration is the way it's treating the press. You know, we have members of the AP, you know, the New York Times, CNN, other organizations that this administration is calling fake news, while they're given, preferred treatment to kind of the marginal, I guess, news organizations, so-called news organizations. They're giving them preference. So to me, it reeks of fascism, and it really, really concerns me.
Jennifer, and we learned also over the weekend that Press Secretary Sean Spicer has checked his aides' cell phones to make sure they aren't talking to the media, and there continues to be a clash with media outlets, some banned from Friday's press briefing. What do you make of all this?
I think there's a few things that are happening. I think in terms of the sort of immediate management in the White House with Spicer, I think that's symptomatic of a larger pattern we've seen since Trump has taken office, which is a larger pattern of disarray in the Trump administration. They have not brought in enough of their own staff. Many of the folks that are there have very grand policy visions, but no real experience with the day-to-day technical maneuvering of governing. So as far as leaks coming out of the White House or coming out of Spicer's staff, I think part of it is a bit of the general disorganization, and part of it also might be a form of resistance from certain individuals to the shutdown of the media that our caller just mentioned. And I think there is broader concern for the way that the Trump administration is approaching the media. It is a logical outgrowth of several decades of conservative media sending the message incorrectly that the mainstream media, such as the outlet I'm on right now, you know, is biased. And so this kind of press ban is sort of the extreme logical, you know, culmination of a very long-term rejection of the kind of reporting that the mainstream media does. It is certainly very concerning from a perspective of democratic transparency, a perspective of giving citizens access to knowing what is real and what is true. I would say it smacks of authoritarian government's tactics more broadly, whatever ism we would call it. And so I think there's kind of the small day-to-day disorganization in the Trump team, and there's definitely the broader pattern of trying to control the narrative and, in fact, mislead voters about what is happening in the administration.
Do you see any truce in sight with this conflict with the press, and is it distracting from other big issues out there?
I think the distraction is definitely a concern. The Trump administration is, I don't want to say running scared. I don't think it's yet running scared. But I do think there is a lot of concern among the top leaders of the administration about where these stories of Russia could go. And so there's a very interesting timing to what the Trump administration does, not just banning the LA Times, CNN, the New York Times from the press room, but say also releasing this executive order about transgendered students, you know, appealing to core moral or cultural issues to occupy the news cycle with something other than an unfolding series of events that are giving voters and citizens more and more information, but still not enough information about how the administration is involved with Russia and was involved with Russia during the campaign. And it becomes so difficult then for us as a community to figure out where to be directing our attention when we're getting pulled by all these different outrages.
Yeah. Jason, thank you so much for your call. We're talking with political scientist Jennifer Piscopo of Occidental College on this edition of All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent sitting in for Kathleen. Jennifer, let's step away from the Trump administration for a moment to talk about the Democratic National Committee. Tom Perez was elected Saturday to chair the DNC. It was a competitive race against Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota, and Perez becomes the first Latino to lead the party. What do you make of the DNC's selection here?
I think that the DNC selection shows that the Democratic National Committee is still very much committed to the Obama legacy. Perez is seen as certainly a mainstream Democratic candidate, but by no means a conservative Democratic candidate. 538 has an analysis where they look at the policy decisions of Democrats. They also do this for Republicans and try to rate them relative to their own party. Perez is slightly to the left of the party. He's not quite as left as his competitor Ellison was, but he is very much centered within the mainstream of the Democratic Party. His policy positions, his priorities look very similar to most Democratic members of Congress. So I really see Perez as kind of a continuity candidate for the DNC and providing a bridge from the Obama era into whatever era the DNC is headed into next.
And Ellison was backed largely by supporters of Bernie Sanders. Will they be satisfied by Perez and having Ellison as the number two in the job?
You know, I think they should be. I think the question whether or not they would be remains open. Again, there is nothing in Perez's record to suggest that he is not committed to the same principles as Sanders or the same principles as maybe more the Democrats that are on the far left, right? Again, he's a consensus candidate, but there's no reason to think that he is not committed to the same thing as the Sanders group will call them. But I certainly think that that Sanders and his supporters want the Democratic Party to be slightly more progressive than it is now. They think that the way to win back Congress is to appeal more aggressively to a more progressive agenda. But I do think there is some wing of the Democratic Party that's not willing to go that far. But the appointment of Ellison as a number two sends the signal to the party as a whole that it's time to fall in line and it's time to unify and it's time to work together.
Do you think with Ellison being Muslim, did that impact the party's choice at all?
I don't think that it did, actually. I do think it was about this sort of Sanders versus the Obama legacy, and I don't mean to depreciate either Mr. Ellison or Mr. Perez as not being candidates in their own right. They certainly were. But I think that sort of Sanders versus Clinton or Sanders versus Obama dynamic was really what shaped the debate more than anything else.
All right, Jennifer, in your neck of the woods, Los Angeles, there were the Oscars last night. I don't know if you heard.
I did hear something about that, yeah.
And as expected, Hollywood infused the awards show with political remarks. And let's hear a bit of Jimmy Kimmel's opening monologue.
I don't want to get too serious, but there are millions and millions of people watching right now. And if every one of you took a minute to reach out to one person you disagree with, someone you like, and have a positive, considerate conversation, not as liberals or conservatives, as Americans. If we would all do that, we could make America great again. We really could. It starts with us.
And what do you think of the awards show last night and the politics of it all?
You know, I think it was about what I expected. There were the nice moments, such as the clip you just played from Kimmel. Many of the presenters and the awardees made appeals to diversity and inclusivity. There were some strong moments. The awardee from Iran did not attend the ceremony right and had a letter of protest read in his absence. But overall, I don't think, insofar as we might say Hollywood has already positioned itself, Hollywood writ large has positioned itself as speaking against the Trump administration, I didn't find anything sort of too heavy or too controversial. A conservative caller might disagree with me, but I think appeals for inclusivity, diversity, reaching across the aisle, bridges, not walls, those are sort of standard talking points, and I didn't find any of them unexpected or sort of too far down the path, right?
We're talking with political scientist Jennifer Piscopo of Occidental College on this edition of All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Looking for your thoughts on the latest developments in politics at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the issues with Russia ties and what is playing out in investigations and in ethics? What do you think about executive orders being issued and their impact on you and your communities? Again, that number, 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Jennifer, we're expecting President Trump's revised travel ban this week that is undergoing a reboot of sorts. The administration continues to defend the original order in federal court. What should we be watching for in the new iteration of this ban targeting people from seven mostly Muslim countries?
I would expect that the ban might try to be a bit more technocratic than the first ban. And so what I mean by technocratic is it might try to clean up some of the policy confusion that was created in the first ban, right? So what about green card holders? What about visitors on certain kinds of visas? And so I don't think the ban will change the countries or the national origins that are being targeted, but I might expect it to be to offer clearer ways of enforcement and clearer ways of making decisions at the border, since that was one of the largest criticisms it faced, and that was one of the largest reasons for the chaos, sort of beyond the moral or ethical outrage about it writ large.
Yeah, yeah. And it's being reported the FBI has rejected a request from White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus to publicly knock down media reports about communication of Trump's presidential campaign had with Russian officials. Was the White House trying to influence an FBI investigation here?
It certainly suggests that the White House is attentive to the FBI investigation. And again, it goes back to the White House's larger concern, which I think we are seeing, of controlling what the media is saying and when the media is saying. It is usually the case, right, that there should be a wall between what the FBI is investigating and the folks that are in power, right, and that the folks that are in power should not be actively intervening or meddling in investigations. So insofar as those reports of those phone calls are true, I would find them very concerning from a perspective of allowing law enforcement to do their job.
And why isn't there a law that prohibits communications between the White House and the Justice Department? Why might a firewall between the two make sense?
Well, I think there are certainly instances where there does need to be communication. So the Department of Justice makes enforcement decisions about hundreds and thousands of federal laws that are often at the discretion of the executive branch, and that head of the executive branch, right, is the president. So insofar as there are decisions to be made about enforcing other kinds of federal law, we might think, for instance, about states attempting to legalize marijuana, right, or states that do legalize marijuana, and the Justice Department with the president's discretion has to make decisions about whether or not DEA is really going to go into states like California and Oregon and step up enforcement. So there are certainly policy areas in which the White House does have a voice, but when it comes to investigations of wrongdoing of the White House itself, that looks very different, right?
Let's take another caller now, Patrick from Richland Center. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, great show, ladies, and your guest is outstanding.
Oh, thank you.
What would you like to add?
I have a question. I she seems like she's good enough. She might be able to reassure me and a lot of other people out here about what's going on in Washington. You know, with the Trump administration, it seems like their underlying rule is insult as many people and disrespect as many people as you can, no matter what you're talking about, and pick and fight what the FBI and Mexico and everything. Anyway, the reassurance that we would like is if these guys do have an end game, please tell us it could be something besides war.
Thank you, Patrick. You know, I think there's a real question about what the end game of the Trump administration is. I think myself, even as a professional observer, if you will, I vacillate between thinking I'm not sure they have an end game, and I think their end game is something extremely nefarious, right? I do think that Trump's campaign led him to realize that insofar as there are a lot of voters who feel for a very long time that neither party has listened to them, that there is something cathartic in anger and insults and disrespect. I certainly disagree. I don't think that there is anything cathartic in being mean or belittling to people, especially people who are different than me. But I do think that this was a way that Trump was able to mobilize his base, and he's continued in campaign mode in the White House. I think the reassurance might be other countries sort of get that, right? And so certainly Sweden is unhappy at being unfairly portrayed in the right-wing media, and France and Paris are unhappy with Trump's comments at CPAC about crime in Paris and France. But I don't think France and Sweden are going to enter into military conflict with us over this. And so hopefully all-out World War III isn't going to be the end game. But I do think you're right, Patrick, and other callers are right, to be concerned with how our relationships with our allies in Europe and Latin America will work over the next 4 years, because we do depend on other countries' cooperation to do things like fight terrorism. And so they might be willing to put up with some bombast in the short run, but I think they will also want to see that their policy objectives and working with us can be met in the long run as well.
Patrick, thanks so much for your call. Let's take a call now, Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good afternoon, and thanks for the good program. With that wall on our southern border with Mexico, Trump is neglecting one thing. That has to go through an Indian reservation that lays with its border, lays against our southern border. Most of the tribes are considered sovereign nations with longstanding treaties with the United States government. in an executive order, to my knowledge and a little I know, would not put a wall through that reservation. So I'd like to see your guest comment, please.
Jennifer?
Sure. So you're absolutely right. The proposed wall that Trump would build would go not just through Native American reservations. It would go through privately held territory, land that's held by private individuals. And I think the wall is, again, where we see this real gap in the Trump administration between what's rhetorical and what's symbolic and what is powerful in terms of rhetoric and symbolism, and that looks very different when it comes to crafting actual policy that you're going to implement on the ground. There already is a wall for some portion of the U.S.-Mexican border down in San Diego, for instance. And so this idea of moving forward with construction of the wall, which Trump is certainly committed to, just raises all of these unanswered questions about, well, how will you actually achieve this? And I think there is a lot of uncertainty because just like with some of the other policy issues we've discussed, when it comes to actually making these happen, there seems to be a real lack of technical knowledge in Trump's policymaking team about what the situation's really like on the ground.
Thanks so much for your call. We're talking with political scientist Jennifer Piscopo of Occidental College in Los Angeles on this All Things Political Hour of the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Kathleen, and we want to hear your take on developments coming out of the White House. Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next hour, Linda Blackman Lowry was the youngest person to participate in the 1965 Voting Rights March from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. She joins us next hour to reflect about her lifelong commitment to civil rights, sharing stories from her new illustrated memoir for young adults. It's titled Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. That's next hour. Hope you can stick around. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. We're continuing our conversation with Jennifer Piscopo. She's an assistant professor of politics at Occidental College. She researches gender quotas and representation. We're talking today about the latest political developments in the Trump administration, the Oscars in politics, and a preview of President Trump's primetime address tomorrow night. Join in this All Things Political discussion at 800-642-1234 or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones now with Marty from Lake Geneva. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. You know, supposedly this election, he won this election via the rural worker who is underpaid, their jobs being shipped overseas, et cetera, et cetera. Which of the two parties wanted to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour? And that's a rhetorical question. So I wonder, why did people, in essence, shoot themselves in the foot voting for a party that wanted nothing to do with raising their wage? And I'll listen to your answer off air. Thank you.
Jennifer?
Great. Thank you, Marty, for your question. There's been so many narratives about the election, and certainly, you know, the disenfranchised, disaffected rural worker has been one of those stories. If we actually look at voting patterns for Trump, we see that voting patterns for Trump followed traditional Democratic Republican voting patterns. There were really no surprises in who turned out for Trump, because who turned out for Trump was who usually turns out for Republican candidates. And in fact, many white voters of higher income demographics, who are also a core Republican constituency, also turned out for Trump. So I think there is a broader question, right, of how much rural workers really drove the Trump victory. In terms of the caller's question, I think for many folks who subscribe to Republican or conservative values, you know, the idea of the minimum wage has long been associated with another meddlesome regulation that Democrats are going to impose on business. And so there can be a real disconnect between their lived experiences, perhaps as middle or lower income workers, and the kinds of values and rhetoric that appeal to them as voters. And I think that happens on both sides of the aisle. But I do think we need to be careful about overstating the extent to which, you know, Trump, despite his fiery rhetoric about rural workers, was really placed in the White House solely by them.
Well, Marty, thanks so much for your call. Jennifer, we're seeing contentious town hall meetings around the country back home in representatives' districts. They're grilling their lawmakers about what's happening, you know, to the Affordable Care Act. Are these town hall crowds stirring up a liberal version of the Tea Party? Because Democrats tried to dismiss noisy Tea Party protesters in 2009.
Yeah, you know, I've done a lot of reading on these angry crowds at the town halls, and they seem to be, from what I can tell, a fairly evenly distributed mix of sort of angry conservatives and angry liberals. And I think what GOP congressmen are really encountering is, again, the difference between being the party of the opposition that they were for 8 years under Obama and now being the party in government. So it's quite different to be in the opposition and have your main agenda be simply oppose what the president does, and to be in government and now actually have to implement policies. It's very different to say we want to chuck out Obamacare, but actually what will we replace it with, right? And I think voters, irrespective of whether they identify as Democrat or Republican, are now in that moment of, okay, we want to move from rhetoric to reality. And moving from rhetoric to reality is really tough, right? And it feels good to perhaps oppose Obamacare. It's a way to oppose Obama. But when you face the reality that we don't know what that replacement is, we don't know what's that going to do to our health insurance, then I think people get really angry. And so I think that this is a case where Republican congressmen and women are finding themselves in a tough bind from these protests.
One word or a couple words that keeps coming up is astroturf politics. Some conservatives are calling it astroturf politics. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're trying to convey either. I do know that one of the other key talking points has been that, and you saw this around the Women's March as well, that these protesters are being paid, right?
Mm-hmm.
That this is sort of some liberal conspiracy to pay people to go and to go and protest. And as someone who went to the Women's March, I can assure you that my check, if it's in the mail, has not arrived. It's missing. So I think it's part of a broader way to kind of discredit the voices that are being raised at these town hall meetings, to dismiss them as sort of angry or manufactured or constructed in such a way, and thus not necessarily worthy of listening to. And I think no matter what buzzword is being used to capture that, I think we should push back against that narrative, whether it's angry Tea Partiers, angry liberals, or angry members of both parties, because sort of protest and raising your voice and yelling to be heard is actually part of the contentious nature of Democratic politics. And so when you see members of Congress avoiding these town halls because they want to avoid the confrontation, well, they're elected representatives and they are elected to listen to their constituents, whether their constituents are speaking softly or loudly. And so I think that we as citizens and voters need to continue to demand their presence and demand that they listen.
Let's go to the phones again at 800-642-1234 on this edition of All Things Political with Jennifer from Monticello. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Kate, and hi, Jennifer. My question is, well, first I just want to say something about the Oscars. I think it was over the top, that all the Trump criticism. The generalizations are okay, but when he texted Donald Trump that Meryl says hi, that was ridiculous. And I don't even want to try to explain that to my students. But the next thing is that what do we as voters, besides writing our congresspeople, besides going to all the protests, what can we do as just a basic human being to change things? I mean, how much do we let Trump get away with? Because I can't certainly impeach him, although I'd like to. But what do we do? That's my question for Jennifer.
Sure. Thank you, Jennifer. I think in terms of your first comment, you know, Kimmel's hosting of the Oscars, I think, was very much in line with his sort of standard shtick, for lack of a better word, in his late night show. I think if my students asked me about the tweeting and the hashtag Meryl says hi, I think without placing a value judgment on it, I might say to my students, well, this is sort of symptomatic of a larger kind of pattern of political communication that might be a very immature pattern of political communication developed by our president himself, right? You know, our president gets in tweet wars with actresses, with other public figures who criticize him. Now, whether Kimmel is right or wrong to encourage that kind of behavior or troll the president, I think it does speak to a deterioration, right, in our political communication and perhaps even in the sort of stature and dignity of the White House. And we could invite our students and the members of our community to reflect on what that means. What we can do to change things, I am very hopeful when I think about local and state politics. And I think often, as you said, you can't impeach President Trump and Washington and the federal government feel really distant. One of the great things about these town hall meetings, about the Women's March, is that no matter where people are in the political spectrum, they are turning out in their communities to speak up for things that they care about. And if the Trump administration follows through on many of its promises to repeal federal regulation and federal protection, that means many of these policy issues, for instance, like civil rights protections for transgendered students, are going to revert to the state and they're going to revert to local governments. And so while federal protection is desirable because we want civil rights to be uniform across the country, absent that, you have so many opportunities in your community to push your city and your town and your state to align with your values. And I think a lot of important work can be done at home.
Jennifer, thanks so much for your input today. And Jennifer Piscopo, looking ahead to President Trump's primetime televised speech tomorrow to a joint session of Congress, it perhaps could be a reset with voters as he has these historically low approval ratings you talked about. And it comes after a really chaotic first month in office. What will you be looking for in a speech tomorrow?
You know, I think Trump has had so many opportunities to really pivot out of his kind of high rhetoric, sort of bombastic campaign mode to a more technical, clear policy set of policy stances. I'm not sure he will do that. You know, he didn't do it at CPAC. He'll be speaking to Congress tomorrow night. I expect to see a lot of the same rhetoric, perhaps a lot of the same mistruths that speak to his base repeated. I'm also going to expect him to largely focus on making an appeal for his budget and for an increase in defense spending. And so I do think that's especially going to mean more rhetoric, perhaps even inflammatory rhetoric around terrorism and immigration. So I would be delighted to see a more mature and a more thoughtful president who has really reasoned through the implications of some of his policy proposals. We haven't seen it yet. I'm not sure we're going to see it tomorrow night, but I think voters would welcome it if it were to be presented.
And in the days ahead, we're expecting more information to come out regarding the connections between President Trump and Russia. There's been support for investigations on both sides of the aisle, but appears that though key Republicans aren't particularly interested in assembling a special independent investigative committee. Do you see that as a political miscalculation? Could it haunt them?
I think right now they're making a political calculation that they hope will work in their favor. Because if you go ahead with this investigation, you have to be prepared to follow through on what it reveals, right? And if it reveals extremely compromising information about the Trump's campaign and Trump's administration's ties to Russia, then that could be very serious, and that could potentially bring up the big I word of impeachment. So I think right now the calculation for many Republican leaders is see no evil. Actually, I think I'm mixing my metaphors, but I think their calculation is if I don't know it, I don't have to act on it, right? And so will this blow back on them? I think it will depend on whether, if they don't investigate, any compromising information comes out in another fashion, right, either from the FBI or either through leakers, and then they look quite bad for not having chosen to investigate. But I think right now it's a political calculation of not wanting to go down that road. And I think if voters are unhappy with that decision, then they need to make themselves be heard.
And very quickly here, in a few seconds left, what are you keeping your eye on right now?
I think that is the biggest story. I think what the campaign and the administration knew about any Russian ties, to what extent they actively pursued Russian ties, because that is, in the long run, the story that has the potential to perhaps take down President Trump. And so I think we need to be careful going forward of when we see this sleight of hand from the administration of, say, banning, quote unquote, the mainstream news from the press room as perhaps a way to capture the media cycle by news other than the Russian ties. So I think the long game is really going to be about Russia.
Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jennifer Piscopo, an assistant professor of politics at Occidental College. She joined us today for our All Things Political edition of the Kathleen Dunn Show. Join us tomorrow at this time when we explore why so many young people are turned off by running for office. Jennifer Lawless, who has co-authored a study and a book on millennial attitudes towards politicians, will join us. Thanks to Colleen Duvall, Scotty Myers, Cheryl Gasser, and Judith Sears-Poisson for producing and directing this show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for Kathleen Dunn.